So I'd actually love to keep on talking about you know, the nature of consciousness, but we need to move to an equally depressing topic to get into this lovely sunny afternoon. And actually, it's even more depressing because I guarantee you something that all of you can relate to. Addictions, I don't need to tell you, are very common. You read the newspaper, we all know about the opioid crisis in Canada, etc. The other topic I'm going to be integrating with is sin, which is also very common and something I'm sure that everyone is familiar with, has personal experience with. I'm an expert on it. Both of these are, well, sin is universal, addiction is very common. Both of them are complex. And I'm going to argue that there's a lot of commonalities between them, including things like denial, self-deception. And I'm going to suggest that they both have their roots in feelings of discomfort, which lead to avoidance behavior. I'm going to suggest that a psychological understanding of addiction can inform our theological understanding of sin, and vice versa. So, addictions, here are some common examples. Oh, I just saw about six people putting away their cell phones. The addictions do not respect geography or gender, location, social class, age. It has multiple psychological, relational, spiritual, and societal influences and consequences. Interestingly, the term addiction is actually relatively new, but the concept has been around probably as long as humans have, and you can consider the multiple biblical admonitions to avoid getting drunk, for example. There's multiple issues and questions that arise with addictions. Is it a disease or a moral lapse? Is it an illness or a symptom of an illness? Is it a chemical disorder or a psychological problem? Are addicts victims or sinners? And that's actually the title of the book. Also multiple definitions. So the American Society of Addiction Medicine emphasizes that addiction is a disease, but then goes on to say that there are characteristic psychological, social, and spiritual manifestations that results in individuals pathologically pursuing reward and or relief by substance abuse and other behaviors. Now, Gabor Maté has a simpler definition that I like. And by the way, he's a family physician who works in inner city Vancouver, so we have Canadian and local content here. His book is called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. So he emphasizes addiction as a behavior. And then Gerald May, in his excellent book, Addiction and Grace, emphasizes addiction as a state and emphasizes that it is enslaving. So there's multiple common characteristics of addiction. It can be all-consuming. So people get obsessed with their addictions. Alcoholics will talk about thinking, drinking. All people think about is themselves and when they're going to get their next fix. A lot of ambivalence. People, you know that it's, you don't tell people that smoking is bad. Everybody knows that, for example. But there's this continual conflict between what people want and what they know is not good for them. People with addictions are commonly impulsive, impatient, generally have low self-esteem. Almost always will have problems with their jobs, their relationships, problems with social skills. And on a psychological level, all these defense mechanisms come into play, denial, repression, rationalization, secrecy, dishonesty is common. So we all know about addicts who say, oh, well, just one more. Oh, well, no, I don't have a problem with it. Oh, I'm not like so-and-so. And we delude ourselves and try and delude others. In the cycle of addiction, this is an example of alcohol. So people might have a first drink, even sometimes for whatever it is, for innocent reasons, but then they lose control of the behaviors, they feel guilty, they say they're not going to do it again, they feel this tension, this pain, start thinking about how they can relieve the pain and the anxiety, start thinking more about the drinking, and that's where the delusions come in, the rationalization, oh, well, just one more, and the cycle continues. Here's another example which can be applied more to behavioral addictions. So again, the cycle of the pain and then the need to act out, and whatever the action is, whether it's expression of anger, etc., leads to some temporary relief, but then leads to that continued guilt and the pain builds up. So in terms of the etiology, the medical model is prevalent in basically saying that addiction is a neurochemical issue. And I'm not going to go into a lot of the whole literature on, you know, disease versus non-disease, because yes, I'm trying in 20 minutes to cover two huge topics, so forgive me for the if it's a bit broad. So I'm going to talk more about the limitations of a strict medical model. So even if there are neurochemical changes, which we actually know there are, it's a correlation and it's a chicken egg thing, so we don't necessarily know causation. Neurochemical theories don't distinguish between addictive substances and rewarding but non-addictive substances or activities, like watching cartoons, playing video games, eating chocolate. I'm getting personal now. Anyway, we also know that genetic science is inexact. The new field of epigenetics shows that the expression of genes can change according to the environment. We also know not now about neuroplasticity and the ability of the brain to change in response to therapy, environment, etc. So biology is not destiny, even if somebody says, oh, well, you know, I was born with this, can't do anything about it. That's not true. All addictions are subject to multiple influence on social, psychological development, and cognitive levels. In addition, not all people who use addictive substances become addicted. So think about analgesics, for instance. Interestingly, if we think of addiction as a disease, it's the only disease that can be treated by group support meetings, for example. Unlike other chronic conditions, a lot of epidemiological studies show that most addicts actually recover by their late 20s. There's some inherent paradoxes when we talk about addiction. So someone can decide not to compulsively use a drug. AA members, you know, one of their mantras is that they're powerless, but yet through the program, they can actually gain control over their drinking. So as I mentioned, differences between chemical addictions and behavioral addictions, for example, but I'm focusing more on the psychology of addiction. So also continuing with etiology, multiple factors that influences, as I mentioned, genetics, biochemical, psychological, environmental, social, etc. There are definite predispositions as to, you know, why some people develop an addiction and others don't. Environment and experience is huge. Up to 65% of those with chemical addictions have suffered some sort of childhood developmental trauma. And I actually also have a clinic in inner city Hamilton, and I see this all the time. In addition, human volition, which Bruce talked about briefly, and I'm also going to be brief, but it's very complex. It's not as simple as we can just choose to do something or not. There's a whole philosophy around choice and our ability to choose. Just going back to the whole further comments on etiology, it's actually not completely understood. And remember that, and this is sort of more philosophical, but how we view something is going to determine how we treat it. So our assumptions about causes and underlying issues are very important. So if we assume that substance abuse addiction, for instance, is a disease, then our treatment's going to be, here, have a pill, treat the disease. If we assume that it's a simple choice, then our response is going to be a simplistic punishment for the bad behavior. So basically, I'm going to argue that it's both disease and choice. People often talk about addiction being more like something that we become rather than something that we have. Choices in the long term can impede our freedom. There's the effects of a short-term choice versus long-term. Our choice is often limited by the context that we're in. So I'm going to talk a little bit more now about commonalities that can underlie both sin and addiction. And Charlie Brown knows about this. So the idea of discomfort or angst, this vague feeling of discomfort, tension, emptiness, is these fears that are usually unfocused and often have an existential nature. Interestingly, some discomfort is actually beneficial. A lot of psychological studies about performance, you might be familiar with the Yerkes-Dodson equation. And from a Christian spirituality perspective, the whole issue of the dark night of the soul, or Augustine's classic line, our hearts are restless till they rest in you. So the idea that restlessness can have some positive benefits. In terms of existential anxiety, which is what Snoopy's more asking about there, developed by Søren Kierkegaard and further developed by Reinhold Niebuhr. So it's a psychological or even ontological state of simultaneous attraction and repulsion to future possibilities. He gives the example of a man standing at the top of a cliff who's simultaneously afraid of falling and strangely tempted to jump. He talks about the dizziness of freedom. This tension relates to choice between self-destructive or self-actualizing behaviors, or in another way, it's said to obey or disobey God. Angst itself is not a sin, but it's a precondition for sin. So there's this tension between the limitations of our creatureliness and our spiritual ability to transcend and reflect on it. So the cliche that there's a God, but it's not me, automatically causes some discomfort. Anxiety relates to temptation. We're free but finite beings, and we're born into conditions that incite discomfort. And anxiety is the inevitable result of the paradox of freedom and finitude. Because we don't like this discomfort, we continually seek to avoid it. And this can manifest in ways such as chronic unhappiness, relationship difficulties, withdrawal, bullying, anger, and addiction. Avoidance can actually even be a code for the term sin that nobody likes. Sin itself has some similar characteristics to addiction. It involves ambivalence. Paul's famous statement of, I do the things that I don't want to do, and I don't do the things that I do want to do, in Romans, and I elaborated it a little bit. Biblical terms, multiple images, when you look in the Bible, it includes, so it's a lot more than just doing wrong or bad behavior. It can include missing the mark, not living up to God's expectations of us, crookedness, failure, deceitfulness. A lot of theologians have classically talked about pride as the primary sin, so being arrogant, wanting to be better, but a lot of people viewed the almost opposite of sloth, or not being good enough, as equally sinful. And their pride can often actually be seen as the flip side of insecurities. The root is a mistrust of God. Sin's a result of human freedom, not necessarily biology. Henry Nouwen, one of my favorite authors, he talks about that, suggests that the biggest temptation common to humanity is not money, sex, or power, but self-rejection, fear of never being good enough. So, sinful responses to angst include moving against others or acting superior to others, and that would be things like pride, narcissism, arrogance, or moving towards others in self-effacement. That would be idleness, dependency, people pleasers, for example, or avoiding others and moving towards objects. So that would be things like self-absorption, isolation, and addiction. Terry Cooper summarizes anxiety. So we can talk about this paradoxes and the cycle of sin. In the biblical authors, we're very much aware of the enslaving nature of sin. Sin leads to more sin. Sin is not always something that we're conscious of, and sin can be something that's larger than life. Biblical scholar Mark Biddle writes about sin as an organic continuum that twists and perverts reality. Serene Jones talks about sin as something, both something that we do and something that happens to us. It's something we consciously enact, and also part of a social reality that we do not desire. C.S. Lewis talks about how people become the choices that they make, and eventually their choices, in a sense, choose them. So in the cycle, we lose control through our thwarted attempts to gain control, and our angst increases the more that we try and avoid it. So in sum, we can look at some of the commonalities between sin and addiction. Both are common, both are complex. Both are a tangled mess of predisposition and willful choice. They both include ambivalence, avoidance, dishonesty, helplessness. They both exist in gradations of severity. Both are counterfeit means to ease psychological distress. Both are influenced by the sin of others. Both can become larger than life and feedback negatively on prior behavior. They include elements of vulnerability and responsibility, compulsion and volition, disease and choice. Interestingly, the language of sin is similar to the language of addiction. Both are sinister, systemic, sometimes objectified. Addicts often deny their problem, but addiction also develops as a way to deny other problems. Withdrawal from addictive substances can lead to anxiety, but many substances also provide a means to relieve anxiety. So self-medication quickly turns toxic. Prevalence of childhood trauma that I talked about suggests an element of victimization or being sinned against in addiction. But we should point out there are differences. Not everyone is addicted. Sometimes sin is just simple rebellion. Sometimes addiction is more of a disease. Other theologians, actually not all theologians, have commented on addictions related in relationship to sin. Skepnik et al. Talk about how people who have been traumatized repeat the trauma. Mate talks about addictions as a flight from distress, an emotional anesthetic. Dunnington talks about them as a potent form of idolatry. And Gerald May says that we all long for fulfillment. We all have an inborn desire for God, and we seek to satiate this hunger unsatisfactorily. Our desires bond to things and behaviors, and we become obsessed with these objects of attachment, idolizing them. So I'm running out of time, so just very briefly, some antidotes to addiction and sin. I think it's really important that we're aware of the complexity when we're dealing with people in churches. It's not simply bad behavior. When we're dealing with people in our churches who have addictions, it's not that it's simply a disease or simply a bad choice. We need humility. It's not an us versus them. Gerald May says addiction is only an extreme example of what is common to all human experience. Kent Dunnington talks about that the addict is an unwitting prophet. He says the prevalence and power of addiction indicates the extent to which a society fails to provide non-addictive modes of acquiring certain kinds of goods necessary to human welfare. When we counsel people, we can expose avoidance strategies, we can uncover the roots and the emotional pain that's leading to it. We can learn to embrace discomfort, recognizing that not all discomfort is bad. We can cultivate ambiguity in our churches, and we can, of course, direct sufferers to the great physician. And finally, the importance of a loving and caring Christian community is essential. Educate people, daily surrender, take up your cross and follow me. Modeling Jesus in our divine compassion and healing, showing grace, showing divine mercy, and showing hospitality, opposing the isolation that is common to people with addictions and to those with sin. Take some questions. It's probably a bit of a whirlwind, but...
But we have time for 10 minutes of questions, so... Who will be first? Yes.
So if you're working with somebody who is maybe really, really wrapped up in this idea of their addiction being sin, so they have very increased self-esteem due to that, and are not really able to kind of see maybe the complex of other factors like past trauma or mental health, or what sort of things would you suggest doing to help, not to discredit the idea of sin being a portion of that, but enable them to kind of see the whole reason why they are struggling?
Sure, multiple approaches, and the answer could take another 3 hours. But try to be simple.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I talked about is the recognizing that we all have some addictive potentialities in us, right? Predisposition. So that is certainly a way build that relationship by saying, you don't want to say, oh, I understand what you feel, because you don't, because you don't have that. So you don't want to do that, but you do want to try and find some commonalities in some areas where you maybe don't have a choice. Asking questions is always better. There's something called motivational interviewing, if you want to look that up, that you're familiar with it, great. I love that, because it asks questions so that people will come to the answers on their own. Looking for discrepancies is one of the techniques of motivational interviewing, and that, again, will help people realize that they might think this about one thing, but then they think something different about something else, so pointing that out to them. Above all, like, focus on something other than the addiction if you're building a relationship, right? So that you can sort of minimize it. And I take almost an addiction counseling approach with many of my patients. You know, I tell people to just, oh, that's just my brain chemicals acting up, and so that it puts it in perspective and kind of minimizes it in a healthy way. Not, you don't want to minimize it in a, okay, you got me.
Are you familiar with Anne Graybiel's work on forming habits in the basal ganglia and how they still remain triggered even when they have formed via the auditorial frontal?
Yes, not that particular, but the general concept. As I said, I wasn't focusing on the neurochemical stuff because there's been a lot done on that. But it
combines those two aspects quite nicely.
Right, but it's again an illustration of the complexities that I was saying, that it's more than like that. The habits or choices actually then have these limit our subsequent choices because of the changes in the brain chemicals, brain wiring, etc. Is that sort of?
Yeah, just because it combined the yes, there's a habit forming, mm-hmm. But at the end, it still can be emotionally triggered. Or
right.
Emotionally suppressed. So
right.
There is that thing of, yes, it's inevitable, but it's not totally inevitable.
Right, exactly.
Yes, it's choice, but it's also emotional.
Right, right. Yeah.
I work in medical education, as well as addiction medicine, specifically tobacco use disorder. And my challenge, not just in teaching medical students about medicine, how do you engage the secular world when you can associate addiction with a form of sin? Once you mention that three-letter word.
Sure. So I wouldn't mention it, but you would certainly could mention choice. And what's really interesting is when you look at AA, AA, people in AA groups are much more willing to say, we're powerless, we're addicts, versus if you go to a church and you don't often hear people saying we're all sinners. So I think there's a lot we can learn about AA. Very seldom do addicts themselves
right.
say that, oh, it's just a disease. They know that there's so much more to it. They know that the complexities, and they know that they have some choice in it. So I wouldn't use the word sin. I would use the word choice. I would use the term, help yourself or harm yourself.
The world will twist that word into saying that it can be interpreted as an abomination. And that's where the peril will set in. So how do you stay gentle and compassionate without losing the essence of trying to help?
Right, right. And honestly, addicts are the most difficult, especially chemical substance use addictions, most difficult, very discouraging.
Would it help to use use patterns of identification and denial that
mm-hmm.
lead to
mm-hmm.
bad consequences?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then examine motivations that cause these patterns of denial and identification?
That would be one way. The other thing I always like to do is look at the positives. So, let's talk about the time when you did quit smoking, instead of all the times where you couldn't quit. Let's look at that. What were you doing? What was the good? What was going right? What are the benefits? Blah, blah, blah. And then another thing is, as I mentioned, and one of my particular interests is actually trauma counseling. So instead of dealing with the sort of the surface symptom, you know, put the smoking aside for a while. And honestly, I've had that with a lot of patients who don't really address the smoking, but as they deal with the underlying issues, the smoking just naturally becomes not needed anymore kind of thing. So getting to the roots, the deeper issues.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Two quick questions. I attend a church where there are people that come in with various addictions. And it seems to me that on your cycle, they would be at that kind of rock bottom, is maybe how we would say it. So I appreciate your ideas about like these ideas cultivating a place of humility. Maybe you can give me some pointers on how you can do that, how I or other people could do that if someone comes in and they say, for example, you know, I'm just 2 days off meth. And for me to say, oh, I remember that sometimes I get addicted. I work out too much.
I wouldn't suggest that at all.
I think there's a place where you say like something like, yeah, we're all sinners, but it can still create an us and them mentality.
Right.
So maybe is there some verbiage or language or even just a stance that we can adopt to not put those people on the outside and kind of find a common ground together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just the simple tell me about it, how can I help you, or that kind of, and just the focusing on something else can be hugely therapeutic, the relationship aspect of things. But yeah, I mean, it's not easy, and I mean, I'm sure we've all had people in churches that everybody bends over backwards trying to help, and they recover, and 2 months later, you know, they're back in the, so I think as Christians, we have to be careful to care for ourselves as well, and not because you can get very easily burned out. But you know, so often I hear, and be careful not to get on a rant here, but a lot of preaching is just very guilt inducing. And I mean, maybe I'm biased because of my counseling experience, but like people have enough guilt. People have enough. There's more low self-esteem in the world than anything else. So we really don't need to be preaching at people about, you know, wrongdoing, you know, emphasizing God's love over God's judgment, his mercy over his judgment. So that's, you know, those are the things where I would be working on in the relationship.
We have time for one more question.
I was just going to add that it's actually, when you read it, it's not just the Christian writers who are suggesting the role of choice. And that addiction is not just a disease. So a lot of non-Christians are really emphasizing the choice aspect of disease more.
Well, if there are no more questions, maybe I could pose for...
I was just thinking, if there's any story from Jesus' life that you would look to as like a model of interaction,
turning the water into wine, and maybe not. the woman at the well.
Yes.
Good. I think it's always the woman caught in adultery. The, you know, first to throw the stone. One of that sin.
Okay.
And one of Jesus never confronted people directly. He always, you know, I say, went through the back door. And I think that's a really good model to follow with people. Is go through the back door, go through the side door, go through any other door as opposed to the front door.
Well, thank you very much.